Subject and object, then, are not two, are non-dual?
You know the Zen koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Usually, of course, we need two hands to clap. And that's the structure of typical experience. We have a sense of ourselves as a subject in here, and the world as an object out there. We have these two hands of experience, the subject and the object. And typical experience is a smashing of these two hands together to make a commotion, a sound. The object out there smashes into me as a subject, and I have an experience. The two hands clap together, and experience emerges. The typical structure of experience is like a punch in the face. The ordinary self is the battered self. It is utterly battered by the universe out there. The ordinary self is a series of bruises, of scars, the results of these two hands of experience smashing together. This bruising is called dukkha, suffering. As Krishnamurti used to say, in that gap between the subject and the object lies the entire misery of humankind. But with a non-dual state, suddenly there are not two hands. Suddenly the subject and the object are one hand. Suddenly there's nothing outside of you to smash into you, bruise you, torment you. Suddenly, you do not have an experience. You are every experience that arises, and so you are instantly released into all space. You and the entire cosmos are one hand, one experience, one display, one gesture of great perfection. There is nothing outside of you that you can want, or desire, or seek, or grasp. Your soul expands to the full corners of the universe and embraces all with infinite delight. You are utterly full, utterly saturated, so full and saturated that the boundaries to the cosmos completely explode and leave you without date or duration, time or location, awash in an ocean of infinite care. You are released into the all, as the all. You are the self-seen radiant cosmos. You are the universe of one taste, and the taste is utterly infinite. So what is the sound of that one hand clapping? What is the taste of that one taste? When there is nothing outside of you that can hit you, hurt you, push you, pull you, what is the sound of that one hand clapping? See the sunlight on the mountains? Feel the cool breeze? What is not utterly obvious? Who is not already enlightened? As a Zen master put it, when I heard the sound of the bell ringing, there was no I and no bell, just the ringing. There is no twiceness, no two-ness in immediate experience, no inside and no outside, no subject and no object, just immediate awareness itself, the sound of one hand clapping. So you're not in here, on this side of a transparent window, looking at the cosmos out there. The transparent window has shattered. Your body-mind drops. You're free of that confinement forever. You are no longer behind your face looking at the cosmos. You simply are the cosmos. You are all that. Which is precisely why you can swallow the cosmos and span the centuries, and nothing moves at all. The sound of this one hand clapping is the sound the Big Bang made. It's the sound of supernovas exploding in space. It's the sound of the robin singing. It's the sound of a waterfall on a crystal clear day. It's the sound of the entire manifest universe, and you are that sound. Which is why your original face is not in here. It is the sheerest emptiness or transparency of this shimmering display. If the cosmos is arising, you are that. If nothing arises, you are that. In either case, you are that. In either case, you are not in here. The window has shattered. The gap between the subject and object is gone. There is no twiceness, no two-ness to be found anywhere. The world is never given to you twice, but always only once. And you are that. You are that one taste. This state is not something you can bring about. This non-dual state, this state of one taste, is the very nature of every experience before you slice it up. This one taste is not some experience you bring about through effort. Rather, it is the actual condition of all experience before you do anything to it. This uncontrived state is prior to effort, prior to grasping, prior to avoiding. It is the real world before you do anything to it, including the effort to see it non-dually. So you don't have to do something special to awareness or to experience in order to make it non-dual. It starts out non-dual. Its very nature is non-dual, prior to any grasping, any effort, any contrivance. If effort arises, fine. If effort doesn't arise, fine. In either case, there's only the immediacy of one taste, prior to effort and non-effort alike. So this is definitely not a state that is hard to get into, but rather one that is impossible to avoid. It has always been so. There has never been a moment when you did not experience one taste. It is the only constant in the entire cosmos. It is the only reality in all of reality. In a million billion years, there has never been a single second that you aren't aware of this taste. There has never been a single second where it wasn't directly in your original face like a blast of Arctic air. Of course, we've often lied to ourselves about this. We've often been untruthful about this, the universe of one taste, the primordial sound of one hand clapping, our own original face. And the non-dual traditions aim not to bring about this state, because that's impossible, but simply to point it out to you so that you can no longer ignore it, no longer lie to yourself about who you really are.
So in this non-dual state, it sounds like you're implying that it includes the duality of mind and body, or the left and right hand quadrants.
Absolutely. The primordial state is prior to, but not other to, the entire world of dualistic form. So in that primordial state, there is no subject and object, no interior and exterior, no left and no right. All of these dualities continue to arise, but they are relative truths, not absolute or primordial truth itself. The primordial truth is the ringing. The relative truth is the I and the bell, the mind and the body, the subject and the object. They have a certain relative reality, but they're not, as Eckhart would say, the final word. And therefore, the dilemmas inherent in those relative dualisms cannot be solved on the relative plane itself. Nothing you can do to the I or the bell will make them one. You can only relax into the prior ringing, the immediacy of experience itself, at which point the dilemma does not arise. It's not solved, it's dissolved. And not by reducing the subject to the object or the object to the subject, but by recognizing the primordial ground of which each is a partial reflection. Which is why the dilemmas inherent in those dualisms between mind and body, mind and brain, consciousness and form, mind and nature, subject and object, left and right, cannot be solved on the relative plane, which is why that problem has never been solved by conventional philosophy. The problem is not solved, but rather dissolved in the primordial state, which otherwise leaves the dualisms just as they are, possessing a certain conventional or relative reality, real enough in their own domains, but not absolute.
Are there any orthodox or mainstream Western philosophers who recognize non-duality?
You know, I've always found it fascinating that both William James and Bertrand Russell agreed on this crucial issue, the non-duality of subject and object and the primacy of immediate awareness. I think this is very funny, because if you can find something that these two agreed on, it might as well be coming straight from God, so I suppose you can embrace non-duality with a certain confidence. Russell talks about this in the last chapters of his great book, A History of Western Philosophy, where he discusses William James' notion of radical empiricism. We have to be very careful with these terms, because empiricism doesn't mean just sensory experience. It means experience itself in any domain. It means immediate prehension, immediate experience, immediate awareness. And William James set out to demonstrate that this pure, non-dual immediateness is the basic stuff of reality, so to speak, and that both subject and object, mind and body, inside and outside, are all derivative or secondary. They come later. They come after the primacy of immediateness, which is the ultimate reality, as it were. And Russell is quite right to credit James with being the first mainstream or accepted philosopher to advance this non-dual position. Of course, virtually all of the mystical or contemplative sages had been saying this for a few millennia, But James, to his eternal credit, brought it crashing into the mainstream and convinced Russell of its truth in the process. James introduced this non-dual notion in an essay called Does Consciousness Exist? And he answered that consciousness does not exist, which has confused many people. But his point was simply that if you look at consciousness very carefully, it's not a thing, not an object, not an entity. If you look carefully, you'll see that consciousness is simply one with whatever is immediately arising, as we saw with the mountain, for example. You as a subject do not see the mountain as an object, but rather you and the mountain are one in the immediacy of the actual experience. So in that sense, consciousness as a subjective entity does not exist. It's not a separate something that has an experience of a separate something else. There's just one taste in the immediateness of experience. So pure experience is not split into an inside and outside. There is no twiceness, no two-ness about it. As James characteristically put it, experience, I believe, has no such inner duplicity. And notice that duplicity has the meaning of both two-ness and lying. The two-ness of experience is the fundamental lie, the primordial untruthfulness, the beginning of ignorance and deception, the beginning of the battered self, the beginning of samsara, the beginning of the lie lodged in the heart of infinity. Each and every experience, just as it is, arrives as one taste. It does not arrive fractured and split into a subject and an object. That split, that duplicity, is a lie, the fundamental lie, the original untruthfulness, and the beginning of the small self, the battered self, the self that hides its original face in the forms of its own suffering. Small wonder that D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen scholar, said that James's radical empiricism, or non-dual empiricism, was as close as the West had gotten to no mind or emptiness. That's perhaps too strong, but you get the point. Russell had a rather thin understanding of the fact that the great contemplative philosopher sages, from Plotinus to Augustine to Eckhart to Schelling to Schopenhauer to Emerson, had already solved or dissolved the subject-object duality. But aside from that misunderstanding, Russell introduces James's great accomplishment in a very clear fashion. The main purpose of this essay, Does Consciousness Exist?, was to deny that the subject-object relation is fundamental. It had, until then, been taken for granted by philosophers that there is a kind of occurrence called knowing, in which one entity, the knower or subject, is aware of another, the thing known, or the object, that is, the two hands of experience. The knower was regarded as a mind or soul. The object known might be a material object, an eternal essence, another mind, or in self-consciousness, identical with the knower. Almost everything in accepted philosophy was bound up with the dualism of subject and object. The distinction of mind and matter, and the traditional notion of truth, all need to be radically reconsidered if the distinction of subject and object is not accepted as fundamental. To put it mildly, and then Russell adds, "For my part, I am convinced that James was right on this matter, and would on this ground alone deserve a high place among philosophers."
So both William James and Bertrand Russell caught a glimpse of non-duality.
I think so, yes. It's fairly easy to catch at least a brief glimpse of non-duality. Most people can be talked into it, as we were doing a moment ago, and at least get a little taste of it. And I think this is exactly what William James did with Bertrand Russell, in person, which is what Russell himself reports. Right after he says, "I'm convinced that James was right on this matter," Russell adds, "I had thought otherwise until he persuaded me of the truth of his doctrine." I think James just pointed it right out to him. See the mountain? Where is your mind? Mind and mountain. Non-dual.
A taste of Zen. A taste of the non-dual.
Well, a glimmer. A taste. A hint of the non-dual. This is easy enough to catch. But for the non-dual traditions, this is just the beginning. As you rest in that uncontrived state of pure immediateness or pure freedom, then strange things start to happen. All of the subjective tendencies that you had previously identified with, all of those little selves and subjects that held open the gap between the seer and the seen, they all start burning in the freedom of non-duality. They all scream to the surface and die, and this can be a very interesting period. As you rest in this primordial freedom of one taste, you're no longer acting on these subjective inclinations, so they basically die of boredom, but it's still a death, and the death rattles from this liberation are very intense. You don't really have to do anything except hold on or let go. They're both irrelevant. It's all spontaneously accomplished by the vast expanse of primordial freedom. But you're still getting burned alive, which is just the most fun you can have without smiling. Fundamentally, it doesn't matter what type of experience arises. The simple, natural, non-dual, and uncontrived state is prior to experience, prior to duality, so it happily embraces whatever comes up. But strange things come up, and you have to stay with this effortless effort for quite some time, and die these little deaths constantly, and this is where real practice becomes very important.
You said non-duality doesn't reject dualism on its own level.
No, that would miss the point. These dualisms, between subject and object, inside and outside, left and right, will still arise, and are supposed to arise. Those dualities are the very mechanism of manifestation. Spirit, the pure immediate suchness of reality, manifests as a subject and an object, and in both singular and plural forms. In other words, spirit manifests as all four quadrants. And we aren't supposed to simply evaporate those quadrants. They are the radiant glory of spirit's manifestation. But we are supposed to see through them to their source, their suchness. This one taste has to permeate all levels, all quadrants, all manifestation. And precisely because this is the simplest thing in the world, it is also the hardest. This effortless effort requires great perseverance, great practice, great sincerity, great truthfulness. It has to be pursued through the waking state and the dream state and the dreamless state. And this is where we pick up the practice of the non-dual schools.
Now, does enlightenment mean something different in these schools?
Well, yes, in a sense. There are two rather different schools about this enlightened state, corresponding to the two rather different meanings of emptiness that we discussed. The first takes as its paradigm the causal or unmanifest state of absorption, Nirvikalpa Nirodha Ein. That is a very distinct, very discrete, very identifiable state. And so if you equate enlightenment with that state of cessation, then you can very distinctly say whether a person is fully enlightened or not. Generally, as in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition and the Samkhya yogic schools, whenever you enter this state of unmanifest absorption, it burns away certain lingering afflictions and sources of ignorance. Each time you fully enter the state, more of these afflictions are burned away. And after a certain number and type of these entrances, often four, you have burned away everything there is to burn, and so you can enter this state at will and remain there permanently. You can enter nirvana permanently, and samsara ceases to arise in your case. The entire world of form ceases to arise. But the non-dual traditions do not have that as their goal. They will often use that state and often master it. But more important, these schools, such as Vedanta Hinduism and Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism, are more interested in pointing out the non-dual state of suchness, which is not a discrete state of awareness, but the ground or empty condition of all states. So they are not so much interested in finding an emptiness divorced from the world of form or samsara, but rather an emptiness that embraces all form, even as form continues to arise. For them, nirvana and samsara, emptiness and form, are not two. And this changes everything. In the causal traditions, you can very definitely say when a person is in that discrete state. It's obvious, unmistakable. So you have a clearly marked yardstick, so to speak, for your enlightenment. But in the non-dual traditions, you often get a quick introduction to the non-dual condition very early in your training. The master will simply point out that part of your awareness that is already non-dual.
How exactly?
Very similar to when we were talking about the witness, and I sort of talked you into a glimpse of it. Or even further with the non-dual one taste of you and the mountain. The non-dual traditions have an enormous number of these pointing out instructions, where they simply point out what is already happening in your awareness anyway. Every experience you have is already non-dual, whether you realize it or not. So it is not necessary for you to change your state of consciousness in order to discover this non-duality. Any state of consciousness you have will do just fine, because non-duality is fully present in every state. So change of state is not the point with the non-dual traditions. Recognition is the point. Recognition of what is always already the case. Change of state is useless, a distraction. So you'll often get an initiation taste, a pointing out of this non-dual state that is always already the case. As I said, I think this is exactly what James did with Russell in a small way. Look at immediate awareness closely, and you'll see that subject and object are actually one, are already one, and you simply need to recognize it. You don't have to engineer a special state in which to see this. One taste is already the nature of any state, so pretty much any conscious state will do.
So the path is one of simply pointing out.
That's right. You've seen those newspaper puzzles, something like, there are 15 presidents of the United States hidden in this picture of the ocean. Can you spot all 15? The point in these games is that you're looking right at all the faces. You already have everything in consciousness that is required. You're looking right at the answer, right at the president's faces, but you don't recognize them. Somebody comes along and points them out, and you slap your head and say, well, yes, of course, I was looking right at it. Same with the non-dual condition of one taste. You're looking at it right now. Every single bit of the non-dual condition is fully in your awareness right now. All of it. Not most of it, but absolutely all of it is in your awareness right now. When you realize this, you say, well, of course, I was looking right at it all along.
And this is the training.
Yes. Sometimes right at the beginning, sometimes down the line a bit. But this transmission is crucial. But the central point we were discussing is that because this non-dual condition is the nature or suchness of any and all states, because this emptiness is one with whatever forms arise, then the world of form will continue to arise, and you will continue to relate to form. You will not try to get out of it, or away from it, or suspend it. You will enter it fully. And since forms continue to arise, then you are never at an end point where you can say, here I am, fully enlightened. In these traditions, enlightenment is an ongoing process of new forms arising, and you relate to them as forms of emptiness. You are one with all these forms as they arise. And in that sense, you are enlightened. But in another sense, this enlightenment is ongoing because new forms are arising all the time. You're never in a discrete state that has no further development. You're always learning new things about the world of form, and therefore your overall state is always evolving itself. So you can have certain breakthrough enlightenment experiences, Satori, for example, but these are just the beginning of an endless process of riding the new waves of form as they ceaselessly arise. So in this sense, in the non-dual sense, you're never fully enlightened, any more than you could say that you are fully educated. It has no meaning.
So these non-dual traditions, especially Tantra, for example, aren't afraid of samsara.
They're not afraid of samsara. They ride it constantly. They don't abandon the defiled states. They enter them with enthusiasm and play with them and exaggerate them, and they couldn't care less whether they're higher or lower, because there is only God. In other words, all experiences have the same one taste. Not a single experience is closer to or further from one taste. You can't engineer a way to get closer to God, for there is only God, the radical secret of the non-dual schools. At the same time, all of this occurs within some very rigorous ethical frameworks. In most of the traditions, in fact, you have to master the first three stages of transpersonal development, psychic, subtle, and causal, before you will even be allowed to talk about the fourth or non-dual state. Crazy wisdom occurs in a very strict ethical atmosphere. But the important point is that in the non-dual traditions, you take a vow, a very sacred vow, which is the foundation of all of your training. And the vow is that you will not disappear into cessation. You will not hide out in nirvana. You will not evaporate in nirodha. You will not abandon the world by tucking yourself into nirvikalpa. Rather, you promise to ride the surf of samsara until all beings caught in that surf can see that it is just a manifestation of emptiness. Your vow is to pass through cessation and into non-duality as quickly as possible, so you can help all beings recognize the unborn in the very midst of their born existence. So these non-dual traditions do not necessarily abandon emotions or thoughts or desires or inclinations. The task is simply to see the emptiness of all form, not to actually get rid of all form. And so forms continue to arise, and you learn to surf. The enlightenment is indeed primordial, but this enlightenment continues forever, and it forever changes its form because new forms always arise, and you are one with those. So the call of the non-dual traditions is, abide as emptiness, embrace all form. The liberation is in the emptiness, never in the form, but emptiness embraces all forms as a mirror reflects all its objects. So the forms continue to arise, and as the sound of one hand clapping, you are all those forms. You are the display. You and the universe are one taste. Your original face is the purest emptiness, and therefore every time you look in the mirror, you see only the entire cosmos.
This concludes Session 5 of A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 6.